and I recall many a time having to bite my lip while some employee, and at times I regret to say members of my own staff, excitedly eulogized the likes of, say, Mr. Jack Nabors. I have nothing against Mr. Jack Nabors, who, sadly, I understand, was killed in the war. I mention him simply because his was a typical case. For 2 or 3 years in the mid-30s, Mr. Nabors' name seemed to dominate conversations in every servants' hall in the land. As I say, at Darlington Hall, too, many a visiting employee would bring the latest tales of Mr. Nabors' achievements, so that I and the likes of Mr. Graham, who would have to share the frustrating experience of hearing anecdote after anecdote relating to him. And most frustrating of all would be having to witness at the conclusion of each such anecdote otherwise decent employees shaking their heads in wonder and uttering phrases like, "That Mr. Nabors, he really is the best." Now, I do not doubt that Mr. Nabors had good organizational skills. He did, I understand, mastermind a number of large occasions with conspicuous style. But at no stage did he ever approach the status of a great butler. I could have told you this at the height of his reputation, just as I could have predicted his downfall after a few short years in the limelight. How often have you known it, for the butler who is on everyone's lips one day as the greatest of his generation, to be proved demonstrably within a few years to have been nothing of the sort? And yet those whose very same employees once heaped praise on him will be too busy eulogizing some new figure to stop and examine their sense of judgment. The object of this sort of servants' hall talk is invariably some butler who has come to the fore quite suddenly through having been appointed by a prominent house, or who has perhaps managed to pull off 2 or 3 large occasions with some success. There will then be all sorts of rumours buzzing through servants' halls up and down the country to the effect that he has been approached by this or that personage, or that several of the highest houses are competing for his services with wildly high wages. And what has happened before a few years have passed? This same invincible figure has been held responsible for some blunder, or has, for some other reason, fallen out of favour with his employers, leaves the house where he came to fame, and is never heard of again. Meanwhile, those same gossipers will have found yet some other newcomer about whom to enthuse. Visiting valets, I have found, are often the worst offenders, aspiring as they usually do to the position of butler with some urgency. They it is who tend to be always insisting this or that figure is the one to emulate, or repeating what some particular hero is said to have pronounced upon professional matters. But then, of course, I hasten to add, there are many valets who would never dream of indulging in this sort of folly, who are, in fact, professionals of the highest discernment. When 2 or 3 such persons were gathered together at our servants' hall, I mean of the caliber of, say, Mr. Graham, with whom now sadly I seem to have lost touch, we would have some of the most stimulating and intelligent debates on every aspect of our vocation. Indeed, today, those evenings rank amongst my fondest memories from those times. But let me return to the question that is of genuine interest. This question we so enjoyed debating when our evenings were not spoilt by chatter from those who lacked any fundamental understanding of the profession. That is to say, the question, what is a great butler? To the best of my knowledge, for all the talk this question has engendered over the years, there have been very few attempts within the profession to formulate an official answer. The only instance that comes to mind is the attempt of the Hayes Society to devise criteria for membership. You may not be aware of the Hayes Society, for few talk of it these days. But in the 20s and the early 30s, it exerted a considerable influence over much of London and the home counties. In fact, many felt its power had become too great and thought it no bad thing when it was forced to close, I believe in 1932 or 1933. The Hayes Society claimed to admit butlers of only the very first rank. Much of the power and prestige it went on to gain derived from the fact that, unlike other such organisations which have come and gone, it managed to keep its numbers extremely low, thus giving this claim some credibility. Membership, it was said, never at any point rose above 30, and much of the time remained closer to 9 or 10. This, and the fact that the Hayes Society tended to be a rather secretive body, lent it much mystique for a time, ensuring that the pronouncements it occasionally issued on professional matters were received as though hewn on tablets of stone. But one matter the Society resisted pronouncing on for some time was the question of its own criteria for membership. Pressure to have these announced steadily mounted, and in response to a series of letters published in a quarterly for the Gentleman's Gentleman, the Society admitted that a prerequisite for membership was that an applicant be attached to a distinguished household. Though, of course, the Society went on, this by itself is far from sufficient to satisfy requirements. It was made clear, furthermore, that the Society did not regard the houses of businessmen or the newly rich as distinguished, and in my opinion this piece of outdated thinking crucially undermined any serious authority the Society may have achieved to arbitrate on standards in our profession. In response to further letters in a quarterly, the Society justified its stance by saying that while it accepted some correspondents' views that certain butlers of excellent quality were to be found in the houses of businessmen, the assumption had to be that the houses of true ladies and gentlemen would not refrain long from acquiring the services of any such persons. One had to be guided by the judgment of the true ladies and gentlemen, argued the Society, or else we may as well adopt the proprieties of Bolshevik Russia. This provoked further controversy, and the pressure of letters continued to build up, urging the Society to declare more fully its membership criteria. In the end, it was revealed in a brief letter to a quarterly that in the view of the Society, and I will try and quote accurately from memory, the most crucial criterion is that the applicant be possessed of a dignity in keeping with his position. No applicant will satisfy requirements, whatever his level of accomplishments otherwise, if seen to fall short in this respect. For all my lack of enthusiasm for the Hayes Society, it is my belief that this particular pronouncement at least was founded on a significant truth. If one looks at these persons we agree are great butlers, if one looks at, say, Mr. Marshall or Mr. Lane, it does seem to me that the factor which distinguishes them from those butlers who are merely extremely competent is most closely captured by this word dignity. Of course, this merely begs the further question of what is dignity comprised, and it was on this point that the likes of Mr. Graham and I had some of our most interesting debates. Mr. Graham would always take the view that this dignity was something like a woman's beauty, and it was thus pointless to attempt to analyse it. I, on the other hand, held the opinion that to draw such a parallel tended to demean the dignity of the likes of Mr. Marshall. Moreover, my main objection to Mr. Graham's analogy was the implication that this dignity was something one possessed or did not by a fluke of nature. And if one did not self-evidently have it, to strive after it would be as futile as an ugly woman trying to make herself beautiful. Now, while I would accept that the majority of butlers may well discover ultimately that they do not have the capacity for it, I believe strongly that this dignity is something one can meaningfully strive for throughout one's career. Those great butlers like Mr. Marshall, who have it, I am sure, acquired it over many years of self-training and the careful absorbing of experience. In my view, then, it was rather defeatist from a vocational standpoint to adopt a stance like Mr. Graham's. In any case, for all Mr. Graham's scepticism, I can remember he and I spending many evenings trying to put our fingers on the constitution of this dignity. We never came to any agreement, but I can say for my part that I developed fairly firm ideas of my own on the matter during the course of such discussions, and they are, by and large, the beliefs I still hold today. I would like, if I may, to try and say here what I think this dignity to be. You will not dispute, I presume, that Mr. Marshall of Charleville House and Mr. Lane of Bridewood have been the two great butlers of recent times. Perhaps you might be persuaded that Mr. Henderson of Brambury Castle also falls into this rare category. But you may think me merely biased if I say that my own father could in many ways be considered to rank with such men, and that his career is the one I have always scrutinized for a definition of dignity. Yet it is my firm conviction that at the peak of his career at Loughborough House, my father was indeed the embodiment of dignity. I realize that if one looks at the matter objectively, one has to concede my father lacked various attributes one may normally expect in a great butler. But those same absent attributes, I would argue, are every time those of a superficial and decorative order, attributes that are attractive, no doubt, as icing on the cake, but are not pertaining to what is really essential. I refer to things such as good accent and command of language, general knowledge on wide-ranging topics such as falconing or newt mating, attributes none of which my father could have boasted. Furthermore, it must be remembered that my father was a butler of an earlier generation, who began his career at a time when such attributes were not considered proper, let alone desirable, in a butler. The obsessions with eloquence and general knowledge would appear to be ones that emerged with our generation, probably in the wake of Mr. Marshall, when lesser men, trying to emulate his greatness, mistook the superficial for the essence. It is my view that our generation has been much too preoccupied with the trimmings. Goodness knows how much time and energy has gone into the practicing of accent and command of language, how many hours spent studying encyclopedias and volumes of test your knowledge, when the time should have been spent mastering the basic fundamentals. Though we must be careful not to attempt to deny the responsibility which ultimately lies with ourselves, it has to be said that certain employers have done much to encourage these sorts of trends. I am sorry to say this, but there would appear to have been a number of houses in recent times, some of the highest pedigree, which have tended to take a competitive attitude towards each other, and have not been above showing off to guests a butler's mastery of such trivial accomplishments. I have heard of various instances of a butler being displayed as a kind of performing monkey at a house party. In one regrettable case, which I myself witnessed, it had become an established sport in the house for guests to ring for the butler and put to him random questions of the order of, say, who had won the derby in such and such a year, rather as one might to a memory man at the music hall. My father, as I say, came of a generation mercifully free of such confusions of our professional values, and I would maintain that for all his limited command of English and his limited general knowledge, he not only knew all there was to know about how to run a house, he did in his prime come to acquire that dignity in keeping with his position, as the Hayes Society puts it. If I try, then, to describe to you what I believe made my father thus distinguished, it may in this way convey my idea of what dignity is. There was a certain story my father was fond of repeating over the years. I recall listening to him tell it to visitors when I was a child, and then later when I was starting out as a footman under his supervision. I remember him relating it again the first time I returned to see him after gaining my first post as butler to a Mr. and Mrs. Muggeridge in their relatively modest house in Alshot, Oxfordshire. Clearly, this story meant much to him. My father's generation was not one accustomed to discussing and analysing in the way ours is, and I believe the telling and retelling of this story was as close as my father ever came to reflecting critically on the profession he practised. As such, it gives a vital clue to his thinking. The story was an apparently true one concerning a certain butler who had travelled with his employer to India and served there for many years, maintaining amongst the native staff the same high standards he had commanded in England. One afternoon, evidently, this butler had entered the dining room to make sure all was well for dinner, when he noticed a tiger languishing beneath the dining table. The butler had left the dining room quietly, taking care to close the doors behind him, and proceeded calmly to the drawing room, where his employer was taking tea with a number of visitors. There he attracted his employer's attention with a polite cough, then whispered in the latter's ear, "I'm very sorry, sir, but there appears to be a tiger in the dining room. Perhaps you will permit the 12 boars to be used." And, according to legend, a few minutes later, the employer and his guests heard 3 gunshots. When the butler reappeared in the drawing room some time afterwards to refresh the teapots, the employer had inquired if all was well. "Perfectly fine, thank you, sir," had come the reply. "Dinner will be served at the usual time, and I am pleased to say there will be no discernible traces left of the recent occurrence by that time." This last phrase, "no discernible traces left of the recent occurrence by that time," my father would repeat with a laugh and shake his head admiringly. He neither claimed to know the butler's name, nor anyone who had known him, but he would always insist the event occurred just as he told it. In any case, it is of little importance whether or not this story is true. The significant thing is, of course, what it reveals concerning my father's ideals. For when I look back over his career, I can see with hindsight that he must have striven throughout his years somehow to become that butler of his story. And in my view, at the peak of his career, my father achieved his ambition. For although I'm sure he never had the chance to encounter a tiger beneath the dining table, when I think over all that I know or have heard concerning him, I can think of at least several instances of his displaying in abundance that very quality he so admired in the butler of his story. One such instance was related to me by Mr. David Charles, of the Charles and Reading Company, who visited Darlington Hall from time to time during Lord Darlington's days. It was one evening when I happened to be valeting him, Mr. Charles told me he had come across my father some years earlier while a guest at Loughborough House, the home of Mr. John Silvers, the industrialist, where my father served for 15 years at the height of his career. He had never been quite able to forget my father, Mr. Charles told me, owing to an incident that occurred during that visit. One afternoon, Mr. Charles, to his shame and regret, had allowed himself to become inebriated in the company of 2 fellow guests, gentlemen I shall merely call Mr. Smith and Mr. Jones, since they are likely to be still remembered in certain circles. After an hour or so of drinking, these 2 gentlemen decided they wished to go for an afternoon drive around the local villages, a motor car around this time still being something of a novelty. They persuaded Mr. Charles to accompany them, and since the chauffeur was on leave at that point, enlisted my father to drive the car. Once they had set off, Mr. Smith and Mr. Jones, for all their being well into their middle years, proceeded to behave like schoolboys, singing coarse songs and making even coarser comments on all they saw from the window. Furthermore, these gentlemen had noticed on the local map 3 villages in the vicinity called Morphy, Saltash, and Bragoon. Now, I am not entirely sure that these were the exact names, but the point was they reminded Mr. Smith and Mr. Jones of the music hall act Murphy, Saltman, and Bridget the Cat, of which you may have heard. Upon noticing this curious coincidence, the gentleman then gained an ambition to visit the 3 villages in question, in honour, as it were, of the music hall artistes. According to Mr. Charles, my father had duly driven to 1 village, and was on the point of entering a 2nd, when either Mr. Smith or Mr. Jones noticed the village was Bragoon, that is to say, the 3rd, not the second, name of the sequence. They demanded angrily that my father turn the car immediately so that the villages could be visited in the correct order. It so happened that this entailed doubling back a considerable way of the route, but so, Mr. Charles assures me, my father accepted the request as though it were a perfectly reasonable one, and in general continued to behave with immaculate courtesy. But Mr. Smith's and Mr. Jones' attention had now been drawn to my father, and no doubt rather bored with what the view outside had to offer, they proceeded to amuse themselves by shouting out unflattering remarks concerning my father's mistake. Mr. Charles remembered marvelling at how my father showed not one hint of discomfort or anger, but continued to drive with an expression balanced perfectly between personal dignity and readiness to oblige. My father's equanimity was not, however, allowed to last, for when they had wearied of hurling insults at my father's back, the two gentlemen began to discuss their host, that is to say, my father's employer, Mr. John Silvers. The remarks grew ever more debased and treacherous, so that Mr. Charles, at least so he claimed, was obliged to intervene with the suggestion that such talk was bad form. This view was contradicted with such energy that Mr. Charles, quite aside from worrying whether he would become the next focus of the gentleman's attention, actually thought himself in danger of physical assault. But then suddenly, following a particularly heinous insinuation against his employer, my father brought the car to an abrupt halt. It was what happened next that had made such an indelible impression upon Mr. Charles. The rear door of the car opened, and my father was observed to be standing there, a few steps back from the vehicle, gazing steadily into the interior. As Mr. Charles described it, all three passengers seemed to be overcome as one by the realization of what an imposing physical force my father was. Indeed, he was a man of some 6 feet 3 inches, and his countenance, though reassuring while one knew he was intent on obliging, could seem extremely forbidding when viewed in certain other contexts. According to Mr. Charles, my father did not display any obvious anger. He had, it seemed, merely opened the door. And yet, there was something so powerfully rebuking and at the same time so unassailable about his figure looming over them, that Mr. Charles's two drunken companions seemed to cower back like small boys caught by the farmer in the act of stealing apples. My father had proceeded to stand there for some moments, saying nothing, merely holding open the door. Eventually, either Mr. Smith or Mr. Jones had remarked, "Are we not going on with the journey?" My father did not reply, but continued to stand there silently, neither demanding disembarkation nor offering any clue as to his desires or intentions. I can well imagine how he must have looked that day, framed by the doorway of the vehicle, his dark, severe presence quite blotting out the effect of the gentle Hertfordshire scenery behind him. Those were, Mr. Charles recalls, strangely unnerving moments during which he too, despite not having participated in the preceding behaviour, felt engulfed with guilt. The silence seemed to go on interminably before either Mr. Smith or Mr. Jones found it in him to mutter, "I suppose we were talking a little out of turn there. It won't happen again." A moment to consider this, then my father had closed the door gently, returned to the wheel, and had proceeded to continue the tour of the three villages. A tour, Mr. Charles assured me, that was completed thereafter in near silence. Now that I have recalled this episode, another event from around that time in my father's career comes to mind, which demonstrates perhaps even more impressively this special quality he came to possess. I should explain here that I am one of two brothers, and that my elder brother, Leonard, was killed during the Southern African War while I was still a boy. Naturally, my father would have felt this loss keenly. But to make matters worse, the usual comfort a father has in these situations, that is, the notion that his son gave his life gloriously for king and country, was sullied by the fact that my brother had perished in a particularly infamous manoeuvre. Not only was it alleged that the manoeuvre had been a most un-British attack on civilian Boer settlements, overwhelming evidence emerged that it had been irresponsibly commanded with several floutings of elementary military precautions, so that the men who had died, my brother among them, had died quite needlessly. In view of what I am about to relate, it would not be proper of me to identify the manoeuvre any more precisely, though you may well guess which one I am alluding to if I say that it caused something of an uproar at the time, adding significantly to the controversy the conflict as a whole was attracting. There had been calls for the removal, even the court-martialing, of the general concerned, but the army had defended the latter, and he had been allowed to complete the campaign. What is less known is that, at the close of the Southern African conflict, this same general had been discreetly retired, and he had then entered business dealing in shipments from Southern Africa. I relate this because, some 10 years after the conflict, that is to say, when the wounds of bereavement had only superficially healed, my father was called into Mr. John Silver's study to be told that this very same personage, I will call him simply the General, was due to visit for a number of days to attend a house party, during which my father's employer hoped to lay the foundations of a lucrative business transaction. Mr. Silvers, however, had remembered the significance the visit would have for my father, and had thus called him in to offer him the option of taking several days' leave for the duration of the general stay. My father's feelings towards the general were, naturally, those of utmost loathing. But he realized, too, that his employer's present business aspirations hung on the smooth running of the house party, which, with some 18 or so people expected, would be no trifling affair. My father thus replied to the effect that while he was most grateful that his feelings had been taken into account, Mr. Silvers could be assured that service would be provided to the usual standards. As things turned out, my father's ordeal proved even worse than might have been predicted. For one thing, any hopes that my father may have had that to meet the general in person would arouse a sense of respect or sympathy to leaven his feelings against him proved without foundation. The general was a portly, ugly man. His manners were not refined, and his talk was conspicuous for an eagerness to apply military similes to a very wide variety of matters. Worse was to come with the news that the gentleman had brought no valet, his usual man having fallen ill. This presented a delicate problem, another of the house guests being also without his valet, raising the question as to which guest should be allocated the butler as valet and who the footman. My father, appreciating his employer's position, volunteered immediately to take the general, and thus was obligated to suffer intimate proximity for 4 days with the man he detested. Meanwhile, the general, having no idea of my father's feelings, took full opportunity to relate anecdotes of his military accomplishments, as of course many military gentlemen are wont to do to their valets in the privacy of their rooms. Yet so well did my father hide his feelings, so professionally did he carry out his duties, that on his departure the general had actually complimented Mr. John Silvers on the excellence of his butler, and had left an unusually large tip in appreciation, which my father, without hesitation, asked his employer to donate to a charity. I hope you will agree that in these two instances I have cited from his career, both of which I have had corroborated and believed to be accurate, my father not only manifests but comes close to being the personification itself of what the Hayes Society terms dignity in keeping with his position. If one considers the difference between my father at such moments and a figure such as Mr. Jack Neighbours, even with the best of his technical flourishes, I believe one may begin to distinguish what it is that separates a great butler from a merely competent one. We may now understand better, too, why my father was so fond of the story of the butler who failed to panic on discovering a tiger under the dining table. It was because he knew instinctively that somewhere in this story lay the kernel of what true dignity is. And let me now posit this. Dignity has to do crucially with a butler's ability not to abandon the professional being he inhabits. Lesser butlers will abandon their professional being for the private one at the least provocation. For such persons, being a butler is like playing some pantomime role. A small push, a slight stumble, and the facade will drop off to reveal the actor underneath. The great butlers are great by virtue of their ability to inhabit their professional role and inhabit it to the utmost. They will not be shaken out by external events, however surprising, alarming, or vexing. They wear their professionalism as a decent gentleman will wear his suit. He will not let ruffians or circumstance tear it off him in the public gaze. He will discard it when, and only when, he wills to do so. And this will invariably be when he is entirely alone. It is, as I say, a matter of dignity. It is sometimes said that butlers only truly exist in England. Other countries, whatever title is actually used, have only manservants. I tend to believe this is true. Continentals are unable to be butlers because they are, as a breed, incapable of the emotional restraint which only the English race are capable of. Continentals, and by and large the Celts, as you will no doubt agree, are as a rule unable to control themselves in moments of strong emotion, and are thus unable to maintain a professional demeanour other than in the least challenging of situations. If I may return to my earlier metaphor, you will excuse my putting it so coarsely, they are like a man who will, at the slightest provocation, tear off his suit and his shirt and run about screaming. In a word, dignity is beyond such persons. We English have an important advantage over foreigners in this respect, and it is for this reason that when you think of a great butler, he is bound almost by definition to be an Englishman. Of course, you may retort, as did Mr. Graham whenever I expounded such a line during those enjoyable discussions by the fire, that if I am correct in what I am saying, one could recognize a great butler as such only after one had seen him perform under some severe test. And yet the truth is, we accept persons such as Mr. Marshall or Mr. Lane to be great, though most of us cannot claim to have ever scrutinized them under such conditions. I have to admit Mr. Graham has a point here, but all I can say is that after one has been in the profession as long as one has, one is able to judge intuitively the depth of a man's professionalism without having to see it under pressure. Indeed, on the occasion one is fortunate enough to meet a great butler, far from experiencing any sceptical urge to demand a test, one is at a loss to imagine any situation which could ever dislodge a professionalism born with such authority. In fact, I am sure it was an apprehension of this sort, penetrating even the thick haze created by alcohol, which reduced my father's passengers into a shamed silence that Sunday afternoon many years ago. It is with such men as it is with the English landscape, seen at its best as I did this morning. When one encounters them, one simply knows one is in the presence of greatness. There will always be, I realize, those who would claim that any attempt to analyze greatness as I have been doing is quite futile.
You know when somebody's got it, and you know when somebody hasn't.
Mr. Graham's argument would always be,
beyond that, there's nothing much you can say.
But I believe we have a duty not to be so defeatist in this matter. It is surely a professional responsibility for all of us to think deeply about these things so that each of us may better strive towards attaining dignity for ourselves.
Day 2. Morning. Salisbury. Strange beds have rarely agreed with me, and after only a short spell of somewhat troubled slumber, I awoke an hour or so ago. It was then still dark,
and knowing I had a full day's motoring ahead of me, I made an attempt to return to sleep. This proved futile, and when I decided eventually to rise, it was still so dark that I was obliged to turn on the electric light in order to shave at the sink in the corner. But when, having finished, I switched it off again, I could see early daylight at the edges of the curtains. When I parted them just a moment ago, the light outside was still very pale, and something of a mist was affecting my view of the baker's shop and the chemist's opposite. Indeed, following the street further along to where it runs over the little round-back bridge, I could see the mist rising from the river, obscuring almost entirely one of the bridge posts. There was not a soul to be seen, and apart from a hammering noise echoing from somewhere distant and an occasional coughing in a room at the back of the house, there is still no sound to be heard. The landlady is clearly not yet up and about, suggesting there is little chance of her serving breakfast earlier than her declared time of 7:30. Now, in these quiet moments as I wait for the world about to awake, I find myself going over in my mind again passages from Miss Kenton's letter. Incidentally, I should before now have explained myself as regards my referring to Miss Kenton. Miss Kenton is, properly speaking, Mrs. Benn, and has been for 20 years. However, because I knew her at close quarters only during her maiden years, and have not seen her once since she went to the West Country to become Mrs. Benn, you will perhaps excuse my impropriety in referring to her as I knew her, and in my mind have continued to call her throughout these years. Of course, her letter has given me extra cause to continue thinking of her as Miss Kenton, since it would seem, sadly, that her marriage is finally to come to an end. The letter does not make specific the details of the matter, as one would hardly expect it to do, but Miss Kenton states unambiguously that she has now, in fact, taken the step of moving out of Mr. Benn's house in Helston and is presently lodging with an acquaintance in the nearby village of Little Compton. It is, of course, tragic that her marriage is now ending in failure. At this very moment, no doubt, she is pondering with regret decisions made in the far-off past that have now left her deep in middle age, so alone and desolate. And it is easy to see how, in such a frame of mind, the thought of returning to Darlington Hall would be a great comfort to her. Admittedly, she does not at any point in her letter state explicitly her desire to return, but that is the unmistakable message conveyed by the general nuance of many of the passages, imbued as they are with a deep nostalgia for her days at Darlington Hall. Of course, Miss Kenton cannot hope by returning at this stage ever to retrieve those lost years, and it will be my first duty to impress this upon her when we meet. I will have to point out how different things are now, that the days of working with a grand staff at one's beck and call will probably never return within our lifetime. But then Miss Kenton is an intelligent woman, and she will have already realized these things. Indeed, all in all, I cannot see why the option of her returning to Darlington Hall and seeing out her working years there should not offer a very genuine consolation to a life that has come to be so dominated by a sense of waste. And, of course, from my own professional viewpoint, it is clear that even after a break of so many years, Miss Kenton would prove the perfect solution to the problem at present besetting us at Darlington Hall. In fact, by terming it a problem, I perhaps overstate the matter. I am referring, after all, to a series of very minor errors on my part, and the course I am now pursuing is merely a means of preempting any problems before one arises. It is true these same trivial errors did cause me some anxiety at first, but once I had had time to diagnose them correctly as symptoms of nothing more than a straightforward staff shortage, I have refrained from giving them much thought. Miss Kenton's arrival, as I say, will put a permanent end to them. But to return to her letter, it does at times reveal a certain despair over her present situation, a fact that is rather concerning.
She begins one sentence, although I have no idea how I shall usefully fill the remainder of my life. And again elsewhere she writes, the rest of my life stretches out as an emptiness before me. For the most part, though, as I have said, the tone is one of nostalgia. At one point, for instance, she writes, this whole incident put me in mind of Alice White. Do you remember her? In fact, I hardly imagine you could forget her. For myself, I am still haunted by those vowel sounds and those uniquely ungrammatical sentences only she could dream up. Have you any idea what became of her? I have not, as a matter of fact, though I must say it rather amused me to remember that exasperating housemaid, who in the end turned out to be one of our most devoted. At another point in her letter, Miss Kenton writes, I was so fond of that view from the second-floor bedrooms overlooking the lawn, with the downs visible in the distance. Is it still like that? On summer evenings, there was a sort of magical quality to that view, and I will confess to you now, I used to waste many precious minutes standing at one of those windows, just enchanted by it. Then she goes on to add, if this is a painful memory, forgive me, but I will never forget that time we both watched your father walking back and forth in front of the summer house, looking down at the ground as though he hoped to find some precious jewel he had dropped there. It is something of a revelation that this memory from over 30 years ago should have remained with Miss Kenton, as it has done with me. Indeed, it must have occurred on just one of those summer evenings she mentions, for I can recall distinctly climbing to the second landing and seeing before me a series of orange shafts from the sunset, breaking the gloom of the corridor where each bedroom door stood ajar. And as I made my way past those bedrooms, I had seen through a doorway Miss Kenton's figure silhouetted against a window, turn and call softly, Mr. Stevens, if you have a moment. As I entered, Miss Kenton had turned back to the window. Down below, the shadows of the poplars were falling across the lawn. To the right of our view, the lawn sloped up a gentle embankment to where the summer house stood, and it was there my father's figure could be seen, pacing slowly with an air of preoccupation. Indeed, as Miss Kenton puts it so well, as though he hoped to find some precious jewel he had dropped there. There are some very pertinent reasons why this memory has remained with me, as I wish to explain. Moreover, now that I come to think of it, it is perhaps not so surprising that it should also have made a deep impression on Miss Kenton, given certain aspects of her relationship with my father during her early days at Darlington Hall. Miss Kenton and my father had arrived at the house at more or less the same time, that is to say, the spring of 1922, as a consequence of my losing at one stroke the previous housekeeper and under-butler. This had occurred due to these latter two persons deciding to marry one another and leave the profession. I have always found such liaisons a serious threat to the order in a house. Since that time, I have lost numerous more employees in such circumstances. Of course, one has to expect such things to occur amongst maids and footmen, and a good butler should always take this into account in his planning. But such marrying amongst more senior employees can have an extremely disruptive effect on work. Of course, if two members of the staff happen to fall in love and decide to marry, it would be churlish to be apportioning blame. But what I find a major irritation are those persons, and housekeepers are particularly guilty here, who have no genuine commitment to their profession and who are essentially going from post to post looking for romance. This sort of person is a blight on good professionalism. But let me say immediately, I do not have Miss Kenton in mind at all when I say this. Of course, she too eventually left my staff to get married, but I can vouch that during the time she worked as housekeeper under me, she was nothing less than dedicated, and never allowed her professional priorities to be distracted. But I am digressing. I was explaining that we had fallen in need of a housekeeper
and an under-butler at one and the same time, and Miss Kenton had arrived, with unusually good references, I recall, to take up the former post. As it happened, my father had around this time come to the end of his distinguished service at Loughborough House with the death of his employer, Mr. John Silvers, and had been at something of a loss for work and accommodation. Although he was still, of course, a professional of the highest class, he was now in his 70s and much ravaged by arthritis and other ailments. It was not at all certain, then, how he would fare against the younger breed of highly professionalized butlers looking for posts. In view of this, it seemed a reasonable solution to ask my father to bring his great experience and distinction to Darlington Hall. As I remember, it was one morning a little while after my father and Miss Kenton had joined the staff. I had been in my pantry, sitting at the table, going through my paperwork, when I heard a knock on my door. I recall I was a little taken aback when Miss Kenton opened the door and entered before I had bidden her to do so. She came in holding a large vase of flowers and said with a smile, "Mr. Stevens, I thought these would brighten your parlour a little."
"I beg your pardon, Miss Kenton."
"It seems such a pity your room should be so dark and cold, Mr. Stevens, when it's such bright sunshine outside. I thought these would enliven things a little."
"That's very kind of you, Miss Kenton."
"It's a shame more sun doesn't get in here. The walls are even a little damp, are they not, Mr. Stevens?"
I turned back to my accounts, saying, "Merely condensation, I believe, Miss Kenton." She put her vase down on the table in front of me, then glancing around my pantry again, said,
"If you wish, Mr. Stevens, I might bring in some more cuttings for you."
"Miss Kenton, I appreciate your kindness, but this is not a room of entertainment. I am happy to have distractions kept to a minimum."
"But surely, Mr. Stevens, there's no need to keep your room so stark and bereft of colour."
"It has served me perfectly well thus far, as it is, Miss Kenton, though I appreciate your thoughts. In fact, since you are here, there was a certain matter I wished to raise with you."
"Oh, really, Mr. Stevens?"
"Yes, Miss Kenton, just a small matter. I happened to be walking past the kitchen yesterday when I heard you calling to someone named William."
"Is that so, Mr. Stevens?"
"Indeed, Miss Kenton. I did hear you call several times for William. May I ask who it was you were addressing by that name?"
"Why, Mr. Stevens, I should think I was addressing your father. There are no other Williams in this house, I take it."
"It's an easy enough error to have made," I said with a small smile. "May I ask you in future, Miss Kenton, to address my father as Mr. Stevens? If you are speaking of him to a third party, then you may wish to call him Mr. Stevens Senior, to distinguish him from myself. I am most grateful, Miss Kenton." With that, I turned back to my papers. But to my surprise, Miss Kenton did not take her leave.
"Excuse me, Mr. Stevens,"
she said after a moment. "Yes, Miss Kenton?"
"I'm afraid I'm not quite clear what you're saying. I have in the past been accustomed to addressing underservants by their Christian names, and saw no reason to do otherwise in this house."
"A most understandable error, Miss Kenton. However, if you will consider the situation for a moment, you may come to see that the inappropriateness of someone such as yourself talking down to one such as my father."
"I'm still not clear what you're getting at, Mr. Stevens. You say someone such as myself. But I am, as far as I understand, the housekeeper of this house, while your father is the under-butler."
"He is, of course, in the title, the under-butler, as you say, but I am surprised your powers of observation have not already made it clear to you that he is in reality more than that, a great deal more."
"No doubt I have been extremely unobservant, Mr. Stevens. I had only observed that your father was an able under-butler and addressed him accordingly. Must indeed have been most galling for him to be so addressed by one such as I."
"Miss Kenton, it is clear from your tone
You simply have not observed my father. If you had done so, the inappropriateness of someone of your age and standing addressing him as William should have been self-evident to you.
Mr. Stevens, I may not have been a housekeeper for long, but I would say that in the time I have been, my abilities have attracted some very generous remarks.
I do not doubt your competence for one moment, Miss Kenton, but 100 things should have indicated to you that my father is a figure of unusual distinction, from whom you may learn a wealth of things were you prepared to be more observant.
I'm most indebted to you for your advice, Mr. Stevens. So do please tell me just what marvellous things might I learn from observing your father.
I would have thought it obvious to anyone with eyes, Miss Kenton.
But we've already established, have we not, that I'm particularly deficient in that respect.
Miss Kenton, if you're under the impression you have already at your age perfected yourself, you will never rise to the heights you are no doubt capable of. I might point out, for instance, you are still often unsure of what goes where and which item is which. This seemed to take the wind out of Miss Kenton's sails somewhat. Indeed, for a moment, she looked a little upset. Then she said,
"I had a little difficulty on first arriving, but that is surely only normal."
"Ah, there you are, Miss Kenton. If you had observed my father, who arrived in this house a week after you did, you will have seen that his house knowledge is perfect, and was so almost from the time he set foot in Darlington Hall." Miss Kenton seemed to think about this before saying, a little sulkily,
"I am sure Mr. Stevens, Senior, is very good at his job, but I assure you, Mr. Stevens, I am very good at mine. I will remember to address your father by his full title in future. Now, if you would please excuse me."
After this encounter, Miss Kenton did not attempt to introduce further flowers into my pantry, and in general, I was pleased to observe, she went about settling in impressively. It was clear, furthermore, she was a housekeeper who took her work very seriously, and in spite of her youth, she seemed to have no difficulty gaining the respect of her staff. I noticed, too, that she was indeed proceeding to address my father as Mr. Stevens. However, one afternoon, perhaps 2 weeks after our conversation in my pantry, I was doing something in the library when Miss Kenton came in and said,
"Excuse me, Mr. Stevens, but if you're searching for your dustpan, it's out in the hall."
"I beg your pardon, Miss Kenton?"
"Your dustpan, Mr. Stevens. You've left it out here. Shall I bring it in for you?"
"Miss Kenton, I have not been using a dustpan."
"Ah, well then, forgive me, Mr. Stevens. I naturally assumed you were using your dustpan and had left it out in the hall. I'm sorry to have disturbed you."
She started to leave, but then turned at the doorway and said,
"Oh, Mr. Stevens, I would return it myself, but I have to go upstairs just now. I wonder if you will remember it."
"Of course, Miss Kenton. Thank you for drawing attention to it."
"It's quite all right, Mr. Stevens."
I listened to her footsteps cross the hall and start up the great staircase, then proceeded to the doorway myself. From the library doors, one has an unbroken view right across the entrance hall to the main doors of the house. Most conspicuously, in virtually the central spot of the otherwise empty and highly polished floor, lay the dustpan Miss Kenton had alluded to. It struck me as a trivial but irritating error. The dustpan would have been conspicuous not only from the 5 ground-floor doorways opening onto the hall, but also from the staircase and the first-floor balconies.